Hello, and welcome to the Magic Music Review Podcast. I'm Jim Spangler, your host. Join me each episode as we talk about our love of Disney music. It could be a song, a movie, a short film, a Broadway show, a Disney theme park, or one of the countless other forms Disney music takes. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey through the magic of Disney music on the Magic Music Review. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Magic Music Review. I am Jim Spangler, the goofy guy, your host, and I am just a music fan like you are that loves Disney, and that's what we talk about. We talk about Disney music and why we love it. And I have a special guest with me. If you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you know who this is, a dear friend and musical genius. He's going to cringe that I just said that, but it's true. Mr. Aaron Kaplan. Hey, Aaron.
Hello. Hey, how are you?
I am great. I'm so glad to see you. It has been forever
since
we've seen each other.
Yes, I'm so thrilled to be back.
It is. Yeah, I mean, the last time we did anything was before the pandemic. So
what a time.
It has been a... Exactly. A lot has changed.
Yes.
A lot has changed. I have lost more hair and added a few pounds and...
Haven't we all?
I know. Yeah, well, you know, it is what it is, right? Yep. Especially after the holidays, it's even more so.
Yes.
So, hey, I am so glad that you have decided to join me on this journey of this topic. I know you, from the first time that we spoke, I think you talked about wanting to do this movie. And so I am excited to do it with you. What we are talking about, if you haven't looked at the title of the podcast, is we are talking about the 1940 Disney classic Fantasia. And I specifically say 1940 because there is another Fantasia out there. There's Fantasia 2000, which we will talk about in a future episode or two. But we are talking about the original Fantasia released in 1940. Very excited. It was released in 1940. It's just an American animated film. It was directed by Joe Grant and Dick Humer, two names that you probably don't know unless you are a true deep dive Disney nerd. They were early on in the Disney world and worked a lot on the early Silly Symphonies. And so that's why Walt pegged them to kind of lead this one up and kind of try to connect things and make it work. So it's the third feature that came out of the Walt Disney Studios after Snow White and Pinocchio. And if you're asking yourself, didn't Pinocchio come out in 1940? Why, yes. Yes, it did. Aaron's nodding his head. Yes, yes, it did. Which is another movie that I would love to do with Aaron if he's willing to talk about Pinocchio.
Always.
Some true classics in that. But Pinocchio came out at the beginning of the year, and this came out at the end of the year. Actually, it was released in New York on November 13th, 1940. So it is, it's a way back machine, but you were right. Two 1940 movies. This movie, Fantasia, grew out of the Silly Symphonies, actually. Walt was fascinated with the idea of putting images to music and maybe telling stories or just representing the music. It was the first commercially released film released in stereophonic sound. And actually, for movie theaters to actually display this, to show this movie, they had to update their theaters. They had to change the sound system in their theaters.
Which is one of the reasons why, unfortunately, the film wasn't that profitable because... You know, and good for Walt Disney for saying you have to experience this in the sound that it was meant to be, you know, seen and heard in. But that meant that, you know, not every theater across the country could pay for that. And it just didn't get a lot of theaters to do it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It was actually released. They ended up releasing it kind of in a roadshow fashion, right? Yep. It toured to 13 different cities. And part of the problem was that people thought that Disney was also going highbrow on them. They thought that he was getting all snooty and fancy fancy and just wanted their Disney cartoons, right? And so a lot of people didn't go see it because they thought it would be too sophisticated, and it's not what they wanted. So to say that this pushed the boundaries is an understatement, because its influence is felt today still. The music video world probably would not exist the way that it is without Fantasia.
Yeah. And just, you know, and we'll dive into this more, but like the different types of visual representations that are present in this one film, they're so different. And, you know, in Fantasia 2000, it's takes the same template as this and keeps it going. But there's just so many different things in this one film.
That's exactly right. You're exactly right. And I that's part of the reason I love it. You know, I rewatched it. I had forgotten so much of it.
Yeah.
I, as many times as I've seen it, I watched it again and was still like, ah, I don't remember that, or I don't remember thinking that, or I don't remember feeling that when I saw it before. It's a very interesting film. It's really shown like a concert. Really. I mean, the opening of the film is the orchestra coming on stage, just like at the beginning of a symphony, going to see an orchestra concert. And then we are met with, there are two people in this movie, really, besides the orchestra. There are two people. And one of them is Deems Taylor. And he is, I would call, the host, not really a narrator. He's more of a host than that, because he's kind of explaining what's happening and what is what each piece of music is about, and a little tiny bit of history on each piece of music before the piece starts. And he also tells us what to expect, what to see, which is, I think, is very important, because it kind of warns the listener about what's coming up, because some of it, quite frankly, was shocking.
And, you know, if it's kind of like if you go to a if you go to a concert now, you get program notes that you can, and you can read about the composer, read about the piece. And in this, you know, it's a film, even if there were program notes, you couldn't see it because it's dark. And this is kind of in place of that.
Right. And Deems Taylor, what, can you tell who was Deems Taylor? I mean, I know who Deems Taylor was, but who was Deems Taylor?
So Deems Taylor, the early part of the 20th century, was a pretty well-known you could probably call him a household name at that time. He was a well-known music, probably mostly well-known for his music criticism, as well as he did a lot of New York Philharmonic live broadcasts and was the host and the announcer for those. And, you know, this at a time when everyone was glued to their radios and, you know, early 20th century. So he was a household voice also, you know, people recognized his voice. And you could kind of equivalent him to a less charismatic is the wrong word, but a less animated Leonard Bernstein for what Bernstein would be in the 60s and 70s to American culture.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a really good point. He was even a composer himself.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that's a really good representation of who he was to the American public, because Bernstein was an educator, a music educator also. You're right in that at this time, this was a time where people were just glued to their radios. They were listening to anything they could on the radios. Yeah. So he was a well-known figure. And when he came on screen and began talking, people would know immediately who he was. Mm-hmm. They would recognize him. And that's why he was chosen. That's why Walt wanted him to do it. The other person in this is Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra, Philharmagic. Going back to the Disney park. Yep, going to Mickey's Philharmagic. But the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they are brilliant in this.
Yeah.
But why Leopold Stokowski?
So, you know, at the time in early, and you know, this is the 30s we're talking about, since it came out in 1940. We're talking about mid 30s, and at the time, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and it still is today considered one of the big five American orchestras. But at the time, Philadelphia was kind of riding high, kind of like right up there with New York Philharmonic as like the top orchestras in the country. And Leopold Stokowski was a British-born conductor, and he was the music director in Philadelphia. And he was also a very well-known, not just classical music world figure, but he was, you know, well-known in culture, in society. And Disney saw that Stokowski had this idea of, well, we could take this form that's been around for, at the time, you know, 250, 300 years, and there's a new take that we can put on it, and which is exactly what Disney had with the Silly Symphonies leading into Fantasia, just in a different way. So I think it was this idea of creative freedom and just collaboration that intrigued Disney about Stokowski.
Right. And I think Stokowski as much was interested in Disney too, right? I mean, he was interested in what Walt was doing with his Silly Symphonies and the idea of exposing even more people to these great pieces of work that maybe, you know, people weren't hearing. I mean, people weren't going to the average person was not going to hear the symphony. Right.
Yeah.
Just like today, the average person does not go hear the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I know it's hard to believe. But they don't. More exposure. You know, Stokowski was interested in that side of it, too. They were like two peas in a pod. Right. They were like, like, how can we push this and how can we, you know, make this go? Both very creative men at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. I mean, they met, you know, almost by happenstance. Disney happened to be in Philadelphia, and that's where they first met. And it was a lot of kind of by chance meetings at first. And again, we'll get into this later, but even to do a piece like The Rite of Spring, which was so new and only premiered 25 years before, to riots in the audience. I mean,
and in the classical world, that is new.
Anything that's, you know, younger than 75 years is new music.
Right, exactly.
And so to be so forward thinking and progressive in, you know, in terms of musical tastes, I mean, for both of them, it was just a really happy collaboration.
Yeah, and I'm glad. I think it's a happy collaboration too. I think it made for a very special happening. Interestingly enough, if you I like to use Shazam on my phone. And if you don't know what that is, it is a music recognition software. So if there's a piece of music that I don't know, I will Shazam it and it will tell me. It uses math actually to tell me what the piece of music is. And it's smart enough to even know if it's the same song done by different artists, which artist it is that you're listening to. And it's very smart. Yeah. It is smart enough to know, and these pieces have been done, I mean, recorded how many times? Hundreds of times. It's smart enough to know that these recordings are specifically the Fantasia recordings with Stokowski. That's how specific they are. So it's really cool. I really love it.
Yeah.
I love that. That was a total nerd. I'm going to nerd out on technology guy type thing. So this has become a cult classic in the world of Disney. Couple of things to know is that when you think of Mickey Mouse, this is probably the Mickey Mouse you think of, honestly. You think of him in his sorcerer's hat. Yep. Yeah. This is the one that you probably imagine. And the interesting thing is that it was a redesign of Mickey at this time. Fred Moore redesigned Mickey, started it during The Pointer, which is a cute, cute little short of Mickey with Pluto going hunting, and finished it with this one. And it's the image that everybody thinks of. And we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get down to that part of the movie. But it was a big deal for Mickey to be in this movie. It not only changed the people that would go see this movie, it changed Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
It changed who Mickey Mouse was and what he was capable of doing. He all of a sudden was not just a comedic element. He could actually do serious work and have some emotion in his movies. And so it was big. We'll talk about that later. But let's dig in here. Let's go. How about it?
Great. Let's do it.
Yeah. So we begin, and I already said this, we begin with the movie with the lights coming up, and you see the conductor stand and the orchestra comes in. And I love this. You hear the orchestra warming up. You see them all come in. They're being social. I love it when the harp players come in and put their purses down next to their harps. I just absolutely love all of that imagery, you know, to make this orchestra real, right? And as they're warming up, you're seeing, you know, the different instruments light up as they're playing them. It really introduces us from the beginning that this is going to be different. This is not your normal movie. After it kind of settles down, Deems comes out and introduces himself and tells us what we're about to see. And he tells us this is a new form of art, basically. He says this is something you've never seen before, and that we're really excited to do that. And he educates us, right? He says there's three different types of music, and we're going to see all three of those types of music in this film. And he kind of puts you at ease as saying, he kind of says, I'm going to lead you through this. Don't be scared. This is going to be fun. And we're really going to enjoy it. And then introduces us to Stokowski, who comes out as a shadow. I love that. I love that he comes out and we don't ever really see him, which I know he's kind of this mystery figure. It's so good. It's so good. And then we start in, right? We start in with Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Do you want to give us a little history of Toccata and Fugue in D minor before we talk about the imagery that they did with this?
Sure. So Toccata and Fugue in D minor is a piece by Bach. And again, it was written for one player. It was written for an organist or a keyboardist. And what makes a toccata is a piece that is written for basically to show off the technique and the virtuosicness of a keyboard player. And then a fugue is another type of keyboard piece written for keyboard that has a lot of, the music term is contrapuntal, or a lot of lines that are independent of each other going on simultaneously. And that's important to know because it's much more difficult. We're used to melody and accompaniment. Someone sings or plays an instrument and the piano does the accompaniment. A fugue is where you have two or three independent voices happening at the same time, played by the same person. You have to have the right brain for it.
Right.
And it's something that keyboardists and organists can do, because on an organ you have two hands, but you also have your feet. Your feet play on the organ too. So that's how you can have three voices. So it's a piece that's originally written for a keyboardist, and this was an orchestral transcription by Stokowski. So he basically took the keyboard part and fleshed it out and made it playable by an orchestra. So
brilliantly done, in my opinion, too.
Absolutely.
I think it's absolutely magnificent.
It's also very hard.
That does not surprise me at
all.
It is all
super hard. But yeah, I mean, you just, again, you're taking this idea that, you know, Bach would want to write for, you know, all this, a woodwind section, a brass section, a percussion section, harps and strings. So, you know, he's able to add more colors and really just kind of flesh out the different instrument voices in this work.
Right. And Deems is very clear to say that this is music for music's sake.
Yeah.
This is not music for storytelling or music for emotion or anything else. This is music just for music. Yeah. And so basically saying what you're going to see is not necessarily going to tell you a story or anything. It's going to represent what you're hearing.
Yeah. And, you know, the abstract art, I think, is a great representation of it, because it actually kind of like the term that neither of us can remember about the music visualization.
Right.
This segment does a lot of that. It does a great job of showing, like, here's one voice with this kind of line and this color, and then here's the other voice doing something else.
Right. And throughout this piece, as I'm watching this piece, and hopefully as our listeners will go after listening to this and go watch the movie again, it is striking how well these animators visualized this music.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah. So one thing that I watch for, like in choreography, when I'm watching a dancer or something, is I watch for details, right? Not details in the music, because the details are already there in the music, but does the dancer understand what they're listening to and what they're dancing to, the details in that? Are they responding to the small things that are happening? And these animators nailed this. I mean, they nailed it. From the beginning, with the use of colors and lights and shadows at the beginning of it, because it's so dramatic at the beginning, you know, it's such a dramatic piece. And the gradual abstract images of the clouds with the bows coming through the clouds. I think I can't imagine sitting in a theater in 1940 and watching this happening on the screen. It would blow my mind.
I think it can't be overstated how groundbreaking and how what a high artistic achievement this film was. It's one of those things like I was reading this article about how right now Stephen Sondheim has 3 hit shows on Broadway, which only in his, you know, his recent death posthumously, his shows are commercial hits. They've always been artistic successes.
Right.
It's one of those things where like it was so new, it was so on the cutting edge of so many different fronts that I just think people didn't like, kind of like West Side Story was, people didn't know what to make of it. It was just
so they didn't know
weird.
What to do with it. Yeah, they didn't know what to do with it.
And only after, you know, after time passes, can we really look back and say, wow, that was really quite groundbreaking because of the detail. I mean, the animation is incredible.
Oh, it is. The beauty of what they did is really stunning. And it came on the heels of Pinocchio, which I think is probably the most beautifully animated feature that Disney's ever done from a visual standpoint. This is right in there. They are pushing boundaries of animation further than I think anybody had any idea could be done. And we're going to talk about that more when we get to the Tchaikovsky section. Yeah. I also loved the fact that as themes come back in, the same kind of imagery would come back in with those themes. So from a visual standpoint, it is matching what you're hearing. And it's almost like recognizing what you're hearing, right? It's like pointing out, oh, you've heard this before, right?
Yeah. In music school, we often ask the question, you know, in Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, why is there always a repeat of the first portion? You know, a lot of people have different opinions, but really, they'd never heard it before. So they want you to remember the melody. So you put a repeat when we do it again.
Right.
So this is the same idea. We've heard this once, and now let me draw the connection again. And so that your mind, either subconsciously or consciously, like recognizes that, oh, I've heard this again. And I think it's also worth mentioning that the decision to start with Bach is great because he's certainly the oldest composer of the segments represented.
By far.
But for, you know, all of what we consider Western classical music, he is sort of, he's known as like the grandfather of that. You know, from Bach came Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, everything, Copland, Bernstein now. And to start with him at the beginning of the film is, you know, like a music history class, that's where you would start.
Yeah, it's a nod. It's a nod to him, right? It's a thank you, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And it is definitely a love letter. At the very end, one thing that really struck me at the end of this is the use of the fireworks into the sunrise with the splashes of color that work with the arpeggios that are going up, right? Yeah. It is so, it's just delicious. I don't know any other way to put it. It's just delicious the way that they visualized that and made it on screen. And I also think we need to recognize how hard it is to synchronize this animation with what was going on in the music. And there is a technique that they use for that that actually Walt developed, but it's still not an easy thing to do. That is not, that is not to be forgotten, that not only are these beautifully artistically rendered, they are technically amazingly done.
I'd always think about that because when I was a kid and Fantasia 2000 came out, they talk about all these things about, you know, nodding to the original and all the technological developments since then. And every time I watch Fantasia, I always think, how did they, I don't know. How do they get it to line up? Like,
it's a click track, basically. Sure. Mm-hmm. It's like a click track, except it's a click track based on frames per beat. And so you calculate the frames per beat, and then you can do that. It is so, but it is so technical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's crazy technical and just beautifully done. I just love it. And I love that they, as you said, opened this one with that in mind, you know, with that nod to history. And it's just a beautiful piece to start with. And I also think it's the most abstract piece that they start with, right?
Yeah.
It's the least storytelling, like, it's the least that you can grab onto something and hold it,
right?
It is strictly, like you said, music for music, and they do such a great job of kind of thrusting you into this world that they're gonna create. It's so good, good. Is there anything else that you want to say about that?
Well, you know, we do the same thing today, I think, in classical music. We put the new piece at the beginning of the concert because it's new. People don't know it. And if we put something familiar at the beginning and then expose you to something new, it's like, oh, well, I didn't like that because I just heard this thing that I'm familiar with.
Right, right. So that's exactly right.
Jump in the deep end. Oh, that was interesting. And now as a reward for sitting through the high art, quote, in quotes, now we do the nutcracker.
Which may have been good or not so good.
Right.
You know, I've sat in a few concerts that I was like, I'm not sure why you picked that one.
Oh yeah.
that was an interesting choice. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So a great way to kick off this film and get us into the mind space that we need to be for the remainder of the film. The next piece that they chose is actually what? It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pieces, actually. But it is the Nutcracker Suite by Tchaikovsky. And Deems gives us some interesting history on this at the beginning about how Tchaikovsky didn't like it, was not proud of this work, and how it wasn't heard a lot at that point in time. Where we think of the Nutcracker Suite as just something that happens every year, right? I mean, dance schools all over the country do the Nutcracker Suite every year.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that he specifically said it's a piece that we don't hear a lot of.
Yeah. So, you know, the Nutcracker, by this point, 1940, the Nutcracker was, I believe, less than 50 years old.
Yes.
Because it came out, I think, in 18, like right at the end before Tchaikovsky died. And it was not, it was not commercially successful when it came out. And I mean, it had to, you know, Christmas time is in the plot, which is why it got done by Christmas. But I actually think Fantasia and the Nutcracker, the fact that the Nutcracker was in Fantasia, did a lot to bring the Nutcracker back to the public consciousness. And it was George Balanchine's famous production, the New York City Ballet, that really started the holiday tradition. And now in 2023, or, you know, this past holiday season, I can't tell you how many ballet companies depend on the money that they get from their Nutcracker production to fund their entire season.
Oh, I mean, well, one of the biggest in the country, the Joffrey Ballet, completely depends upon it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you want, you know, your Nutcracker and the boutique in the lobby and the little the little Nutcrackers that you can buy, I mean, that will fund your Coppelia and your Giselle and Swan Lake. I mean, that's just...
Yeah,
and I think Fantasia had a big, was a big factor in bringing that back to the public consciousness.
I 100% agree. I 100% agree. And as I was watching it again, it reminded me of how much I associate these tunes even with Fantasia, right? Mm-hmm. And I've seen the ballet countless times. I can't even tell you how many times I've seen it. It surprised me how familiar and correct it felt to be seeing these images with this music. So it starts off with the Sugar Plum Fairies. I also think the order of this is very interesting because it's not in the order of the ballet, correct, which always confuses me. I'm always like, what am I listening to? What? But we start with the Sugar Plum Fairies, and it starts with fairies and they're applying dew and dancing. And I think it's just so beautifully done. I think it's enough, like, solid visually to go, oh, I know what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. Without being in your face about what it's doing. I think it's so light and done so well visually. Through all of these pieces, all six of these pieces, the visuals are, once again, so spot on to what I think it makes you feel. It makes you, like, it's so close to what the emotion is that you get if you're just listening to this music.
Yeah.
Now, if you've seen the ballet, you're going to be like, that's not what this is, right? But you have to put that away. You can't rely on that. You have to listen to this as just a piece of music, and an artist has created something visual to go with it.
Yeah.
So feel free to jump in anytime.
Sure.
With thoughts on what these images, because of course that's the matching of image and idea to the music is my whole game, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I think it works so well because it is the images that go with this particular movement are very balletic.
Yes.
And, yeah. What's interesting, I've had the great fortune to play the ballet, the full ballet, over 100 times over the last like 15 years, and some things that that are coming to mind about the Sugar Plum Fairy, you know, this is probably the most recognizable melody from the Nutcracker.
Completely, I agree with that 100%.
And there's a lot of recognizable things, but it's also buried in the end of Act Two. And it's 2 minutes. It's, you know, just 2 minutes. So I always think that's funny.
It's also one of the hardest pieces to dance.
Right. And in the ballet, there's usually, these are the hired soloists that you brought in to do the pas de deux and then the Sugar Plum.
That's right.
When Tchaikovsky was in America in the 1890s, while he was conceptualizing the Nutcracker, before he was writing it, he was introduced to a new instrument here in New York when he was visiting, which kind of sounds like a music box called the celeste or the celesta. And that is the instrument that he put as the sugar plum in the ballet. So audience, you know, the audience will recognize, you know, the Harry Potter bum, 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 Hedwig's theme. That's a celeste.
Right. Right.
And, you know, that the first time that was ever used in an orchestral piece, I believe, was Sugar Plum Fairy in the Nutcracker.
Yeah. And it is iconic with it. Right. It's totally what you think of when you think of the ballet. And I just think it's beautiful. I think the swooping and just the doing and the flowers and stuff is just so well matched to what the music is actually doing. We then go. It's such a weird jump to me. We then go to the Chinese dance in this with the mushrooms, which I think visually is the most recognizable of this suite, right? Especially for Fantasia. Everybody knows the mushrooms. Everybody knows the cute little baby mushroom. It is at the same time cute and adorable and offensive.
Yep.
It's both, right? And it was not meant to be offensive at the time at all. They were trying to match what the music sounded like to what they saw in their minds. But it's like a little circus chase. It's like a, I don't know what else to describe it as, because there's not a lot that happens.
No, they're just kind of, you know, dancing around each other.
They're just kind of running around and bowing to each other and
yeah. And I mean, that's probably why the rating on Disney Plus for Fantasia, you know, says, you know, some out of date offensive visual.
Yeah, there's another piece also that we're going to talk about with that, because there's that also gets that that also causes that is a little shocking. That actually doesn't exist anymore. I don't even think you can find it unless you have an old copy.
I do.
Yeah.
I've got the VHS from 1993.
That's the only way you can see some of the offensive and it's bad. So the Chinese dance, everybody knows it's the mushrooms running around and it's very cute. And the little baby mushroom is very cute. And then we then go to the dance of the reeds.
Mm-hmm.
This piece is almost meditative to me when I watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the floating flowers and then that turn into kind of a human form. to continue the movement of this. It's very mesmerizing, is the word I would use for it.
Yeah. What's interesting about these, the way that the animators interpreted these dances, because the names come from, in the ballet, it's the land of the sweets. So the Chinese dance is tea. And the Arabian dance is coffee, right? And so although those sweets aren't necessarily in the animation, I see some correlation between like the type of, going back to the Chinese dance for a second, the idea of tea and the mushrooms, like I see some sort of connection between the actual suite that it originally was and how they chose to animate it, just kind of in the representation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's very true. I think that's very true. And I truly enjoyed it. And then I think my favorite in this sequence is the Arabian dance.
Yeah.
With these fish. I never thought that an animated fish could be seductive. Mm-hmm. But these fish are very seductive. I think the use of their fins as veils.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is magnificent. And even though most of the fin, you can't see it.
Right.
It is outlined just enough so that you know what the shape of it is and what it's doing. It is, I think of these, it may animation wise in the Nutcracker suite be my favorite visual representation. Mm-hmm. I just think that this is just so.
Yeah.
Just seductive, and it draws you in, and you're not quite, it's kind of like, what is happening?
for me, this is the meditative one for me.
Okay.
I don't know why, but that's always how I've felt about that one.
Yeah. I just think it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful. And we can talk forever about how well they match what's going on to the music. With all of these pieces.
Yeah. I've always wondered how they come up with their, like, what made them think about fish for this one, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And one of the notes that I have from watching it this last time is that I feel like this particular sequence is a masterclass of animation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is a masterpiece of simplicity. These are not sophisticated drawings. Mm-hmm. It is just a masterclass of animation. It's just so beautifully done. The less is more lesson of animation. Really, really beautiful done. Then we go to the Russian dance, which is actually my least favorite of all of these. Sure. I think because it's the most literal representation.
Yeah, yes.
I think that's why. I think I've seen all these things that are not literal representations, and then all of a sudden,
right,
I'm watching flowers that look like Russian dancers,
right?
You know, and are doing Russian dance,
right?
And so I think it's probably the least. I still enjoy it. Don't get me wrong; it's still fun. But I think if I had to choose, it would probably be the least piece probably in the whole movie. Honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
You're like, I'm not sure I agree with you, Jim. I don't think.
No.
That's right.
I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, I just think it's the most, I think it's the least creative risk taken.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And maybe that's why, being a creative person, maybe that's why it's my least favorite. It is the least risk taken in this
film. Yeah. Totally. So,
and then we end with the Waltz of the Flowers,
mm-hmm.
which is, I love this one so much.
I do too.
I love that we're back to the fairies or fireflies.
Right.
I think you could go either way on that original initial scene, right, as they come in, because the wings are really firefly wings.
Right.
And then I love when they shift to showing us the leaves and the different kinds of leaves being manipulated by the breeze and the wind to match musically what's happening. Absolutely love when they add all of the only thing I know how to describe these are is those little poof seeds, those little you know, like when you blow a dandelion type of seeds. I love the use of that in the waltz aspect of it. It really gives the feel of that up and down and waltz feel that you get. And I think the most beautiful thing animated in all of this are the Frost Fairies.
Oh, yeah. I love the Frost Fairies.
The Frost Fairies are just so gorgeous, and they're on for such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. They had to have been impossible to animate.
Right. And when I think
of... I can't imagine.
Yeah. When I think of this sequence, that's the image when I of the Nutcracker in Fantasia. The Frost Fairies are what I think of.
Yeah. They are. Oh, they're just so gorgeous. And then that drifts into Snow Fairies. Snowflake Fairies, when the snow is coming down. We've basically watched the transition of seasons in that moment. I just love it. I think it's a beautiful way to end this piece. It doesn't end with a bang, right? It doesn't end with a big bang. It ends with a just nice, quiet, subtle ending, like the snow falling, drifting and falling.
Right.
It's so beautiful.
I think it's a nice little parallel, because in the ballet, the end of Act 1 is the Waltz of the Snowflakes, and this is the big waltz in Act 2, which is not snowing, but it's nice that they kind of made that little parallel.
They made that connection. I totally agree. And that's exactly what I thought, too. And for some reason in my head, I had that the end of it had like this big snow puff that went up. I don't know why I thought that. You know how you think things that don't actually exist?
Right.
It's the Mandela, the Mandela effect or something like that. Right. I totally thought I kept waiting for it. I was like, oh, I guess it's not there. I guess I have no idea what I was thinking about. I don't know what I'm talking about. All right. Then we go. So that ends our Nutcracker suite.
Yeah.
And that has been playing this whole entire time back behind the scenes. I've changed the music as we've been going. So hopefully you were paying attention to the music back there. Disney's very fussy about their Fantasia movie and music. I just have to be a little careful with it.
Yeah. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Please.
I just thought one of the other nice things about the Fantasia or the Nutcracker sequence is, and when I teach movements of the Nutcracker, I talk about this. These tempos, because they're not inhibited by or influenced by dancers, they don't need to accompany. The concert tempos of these suites can be totally different than how you'd actually hear them in a ballet performance. Because in ballet, it's all about the tempo as desired by the dancer.
Right.
And here, because it was for the film, it wasn't for any specific dancer choreographer, you could do... Stokowski could do any tempo he wanted, you know, within the realm of Stokowski's markings. But, you know, usually the Waltz of the Flowers can be pretty slow, or the Sugar Plum Fairy is very slow. But here he could do whatever he wanted. So that's just a nice little.
Nice. And that gives us a kind of an insight into his artistic vision also, right? Way of thinking of this music and how he wants to hear this music. I had not thought of that. Thank you for bringing that up. I had not thought about that at all. That'll come into play later on when we talk about some other things too.
For sure.
Very good. So next is the piece that everybody knows. It's the heavy hitter. When you think of Fantasia, this is what you think of. When you look at a poster for Fantasia, this is what you see. This is The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas. And it is Mickey's big starring. It's his big star turn. Honestly, because he's just been in shorts all up to this point and doing, you know, just things, his comedic, mischievous self, which I love.
Yeah.
But this was his big break into the movies and really changed his trajectory as a character, I think. Yeah. But first I want you, can you talk, and if you can, it's okay. Can you talk a little bit about Dukas as a composer? And who he was, I find him so fascinating. And I remember studying him in music history and thinking, what an interesting character.
Yeah.
For somebody that wrote such magnificent music.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I have this hypothesis that, I mean, Paul Dukas was, he was a French composer. He just died in 1935. So it's possible that you know, maybe Disney was thinking about this still while he was alive, but it was, you know, it was recent. That, I mean, it was a pretty, we consider him a modern composer at the time.
Right.
And I have this hypothesis that if it weren't for Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia, he would be one of the hundreds of composers who would have just kind of been lost to the sands of time.
I think you're right. I think you're right, because he was not interested in his music being played.
No.
Publicly, in public performances.
Right. And he's sort of like a, we'd call him like a one-hit wonder. Like Pachelbel gets that a lot. Yeah, he wrote The Canon.
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah, yeah.
We know Paul Dukas as, I mean, well, most people don't know who Paul Dukas is, but classical musicians, if you were to ask what else did Paul Dukas write, probably most classical musicians wouldn't be able to name two other pieces that he wrote.
That's a true statement.
Yeah. And which is funny because I think the Sorcerer's Apprentice as a piece is so wonderful. I think it's really, it's in the totally in the romantic, programmatic sort of zeitgeist of what that time period and Debussy, what they were all writing in. And I do think, like, from an orchestrational standpoint, and that means like how he uses the instruments to color the whole sound palette, I think it's really quite wonderful and nuanced and sort of, and again, very forward thinking. I think it's a fantastic piece. Other than this piece, you don't hear him a lot.
Right. Exactly. And I also know from my research just recently on him, I did not realize how much he influenced other composers through his teaching.
Yeah.
He was almost more in that world, in the world of composers, he was known more of as a teacher,
right,
than a writer. And so I find it so fascinating that he wrote such a beautiful piece and just was kind of back in the, you know, in the background of everything that was happening at the time. Yeah. And if he hadn't died in 1935, it would be interesting to see what would have happened after Fantasia came out.
Like, would he have been appreciative of the accolades and success? We don't know.
Exactly. We don't know. Very interesting, because most composers write because they want their stuff to be heard.
Right.
And so for a composer to have that introvert quality to the extent of, I just don't listen to it. It's not,
right,
you know, I don't want it heard, is very odd. It's very odd for a composer. And I agree with you that if it were not for this movie, he probably would have been lost in the history of music. Yeah. I totally agree.
I can only name one other piece that he wrote, and it's a fanfare from a ballet that he wrote called La Pairie, but that's it. And I only know that because I looked up other things that when I was studying Sorcerer's Apprentice in grad school, I looked up, you did my research on him and recognized a piece that he wrote. But other than that, that's it.
Yeah, that's it's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. So this is actually, this is obviously, that's the word I was looking for. Actually, obviously, you know, it's very similar. this is a piece of music that tells a story. I love this story, and I think the casting of Mickey was perfect in this, because of Mickey's innocence that he has also. I think it was just absolutely perfect and beautifully animated to both use the best of the music and use the best of what Mickey Mouse had to offer.
I mean,
it came at the perfect time, right? It's the iconic Mickey. It's the Mickey that most people think about, with the sorcerer's hat and the robe. And I love that so much of what we think about in this piece, like with him up on the rock directing the storm, you know, having the waves come up and stuff, is actually him dreaming.
Right.
I love that he's fallen asleep and it's actually him dreaming. And then I did not realize, actually, this is kind of a violent little piece. And I say that because when he goes after that poor broom with that axe, they do not hide what he's doing. They show it in shadow, but it is Mickey being, he's being violent. He's destroying that broom, right? Because it's the only way he can figure out to make it stop. But it's quite it's quite a 30-second little, or not even 30 seconds, probably 15 seconds of Mickey Mouse that we would never see, right? Because he panics and destroys the broom. And of course, as we all know, they come back to life. All the little pieces come back to life, which I love, to be filling the basement still. One of my favorite images is of all the brooms throwing the water over the stairwell, when they're all just lined up on the stairwell and throwing the water over.
Yeah. And talk about things being timed to the music. I mean, the wave crashing and, you know, not just Mickey's conducting, but even, you know, when he's, kind of bounced out of there at the end on the last,
right.
Everything is so timed up. And it's worth mentioning also that the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice is actually by the German writer Goethe.
Oh, well, there you go. See, I did not know that. Oh. I did not know that. Does Deem say that at the beginning of it? Because I know he talks about the story. I don't remember if Deems Taylor mentions that that's who wrote it.
I don't know if he does. I don't remember.
I'd have to go back and listen. Now, for all of the listeners out there, listen to it and let me know. Go back and watch that and let me know if Deems Taylor actually mentions that Goethe is who wrote the story. You know, so many iconic images from this, the waves that he's conducting, and you're talking about the timing with the waves and stuff. I also watched paid particular attention to Mickey conducting those waves and his timing and how perfectly timed his arm movement is with that. Like, there's no, it's absolutely flawless. Flawless. And also the image of him writing his spell book. I think we've all seen that image of him on top of the spell book surrounded by water.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I don't know that there's a whole lot more to talk about with this piece. It's a very fun piece. I think it tells the story well. And I think they animated the story well with it.
Yeah.
You know, they used the music that was given to tell the story. And it's the way I want to see the story now. It's the way I want the story to be.
Yeah. In the type of era that Dukas wrote in is the Romantic era, and that was for music, but also literature and in architecture and all sorts of, you know, the humanities. And one of the big hallmarks of Romantic era music is that it's programmatic, that is meant to tell a story. And so this is a perfect example of the animators taking the text and the music working together to tell this story of Goethe's poem.
It's really a pretty humanities-driven piece, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's Goethe's story with music and art.
Yeah.
It's like a moment of time in humanities, which I love. Yeah. I think it's so cool. It's so cool.
I have a piece of trivia. Do you know the name of the sorcerer?
Yes, I do. Of course I do.
Of course you do.
Yes, of course I do. The sorcerer's name, for those of you that don't know, is Yen Sid. And if you are quick enough and have done this before, I tell you, it's actually Disney spelled backwards. I have to tell you, Aaron, that's the piece of trivia that so many people give me all the time.
I'm not surprised.
it's like, do you know the sorcerer's name? I'm like, yes, I do. Yeah, I do. I think it's great though. I think it's so cool that that's what they did.
Yeah. Yeah.
A nice, well hidden little nugget in there. Yeah. So well done. So the next piece that we move to, speaking of Dukas and having influence on people, and we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, is the ballet, The Rite of Spring. You want to talk a little bit about The Rite of Spring?
Sure. Well, so I think it's important to mention that Igor Stravinsky, Russian composer, was alive for this, during Fantasia, and Stravinsky and Disney met. And in fact, Stravinsky was a huge proponent of his work going in here, and really thankful to Walt Disney for doing it. And even helped come up with the cuts that they would use for the film.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, because the full ballet is about 35 minutes, and I think this segment's about 18 to 20. So he helped Disney come up with the cuts. And in a nutshell, so Stravinsky was sort of the poster child for what we would call the modern era of music, modern being like 20th century, which is 100 years ago, but, you know, right. That's what we'll call it. And right. He wrote a ton of wonderful pieces. The three most famous are probably his ballets, Petrushka, The Firebird, and The Rite of Spring. Firebird, people might know because that comes in Fantasia 2000. The Rite of Spring is in Fantasia, and he wrote this for the choreographer Sergei Diaghilev at the Ballet Russe in Moscow. And it was a commission, and the original ballet is about basically the sacrificing of pagan rituals. The music was very avant-garde when it came out in 1913, very angular, a lot of chords that are dissonant to the ear that make us feel uncomfortable. You know, it's funny because nowadays the piece is revered and it still sounds a little dissonant, but it...
I was about to say, I would even say it still sounds a little avant-garde.
Yeah, but, you know, and that's now. And then the famous story is that when it premiered in 1913, there were riots in the audience. And part of that was the choreography because there was nudity on stage and, you know, the sacrificial dance at the end is exactly what you think is happening. People are being sacrificed. And the music is very rhythmically very strong because it's like, you know, it's these earthly dance rituals and movements, and it's angular and asymmetrical. So it kind of feels unsettling. And so there were riots in the audience. That's the famous story, that there were riots and it was booed and did not receive critical acclaim at the time. And that was only in 1913. So for Disney in the mid-30s to have the idea of putting this in his film, I would imagine some people thought he was crazy.
Of course, of course. And I think it's interesting to know that when the collaboration of Diaghilev, and people need to know he is a really famous choreographer. Yeah. It's not like somebody unknown person asked Stravinsky to do this. This is a really famous choreographer that asked to do this, and it was to be primitive.
Yeah.
It was to display primitive life. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind when Disney then decided to add this, because Disney's approach was to show the development of life on our planet, right up through the dinosaur. And it is quite shocking, honestly, because it's not friendly.
No.
Right. It's not welcoming. It's not cute. It is very much so nature. It is survival of the fittest. You see lots of things dying, lots of things getting eaten. It's very interesting that they chose this approach, right? Because they took what it was written for and said, well, how do we dial that down even more? Right. How do we, you know, well, we're talking about primitive life. Well, what's more primitive than when life began on our planet, right? And one of the things that really strikes me is that the piece starts off with us with a way back picture of the universe, right? Of a field of stars, this universe, and then us slowly going through that field of stars until we get to planet Earth, right? Yeah. Which is just forming when we get to it. But the amount of time that those artists take and the patience that is shown in the zooming in to that planet.
Right.
Does such an amazing job of not only showing the expanse of the universe, but just how small we are in that universe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because there were moments I literally was watching going, is anything happening?
Right.
And what's going on? Right. And the music is going on, of course. But I think it's so fascinating that they were able to patiently work on that, because it would have been very easy to go back to Stravinsky and say, can we cut some of this out?
Right.
Right. And Stravinsky probably would have been like, I can do that. I can do that.
Yeah. Right?
But the fact that they decided to be so patient to get to that initial image of a forming planet.
Yeah.
It's just stunning.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the first this opening sequence that you're saying, that we're talking about, is similar kind of to the ballet, because the first part, the ballet is in two parts. The first part is called The Adoration of the Earth, where they're talking, they're dancing, but they're celebrating life on Earth before the more primitive things happen in the second half. And this first, you know, the first 5-6 minutes of the animated sequence is exactly that. It's the forming of Earth, sort of the first, you know, billion years of life coming together before we get to the on Earth section.
Yeah. And then I love, once we do get there, I love the use of lava explosions and lava flow to represent what's happening musically with it, because it's very explosive music. It's very percussive, very rhythmic. And then it runs into the water, which completely changes the feel of what's going on, right? And then we start seeing in the water and what's happening and the evolution of life in the water. I thought it was very fascinating. I also like the way that time passes. The use of the clouds that come up, the dark clouds that come up between, I would say, scenes, to show that time has passed.
Right.
Because millions of years pass each time the clouds come up. Otherwise, we would still be watching that film. It would be really long. So I thought it was very fascinating, the use of those techniques in the sense of what this music is and how unsettling the music is, because it really is unsettling. Stravinsky does an amazing job of never letting us feel comfortable.
Right. Yeah.
He never lets us, you know, so often when you listen to a piece of music, you begin to kind of understand what's going on and where it's going and what's happening. And part of the time that he was writing and what was happening during that time was that percussiveness and that use of rhythm and that use of not feeling comfortable.
Right.
With part what of you the, were doing.
Part of the reason why music makes us feel things is because there's this tension and release, right? And when there's just tension and no release, then we get riots, I guess.
Right. Then we get riots. Because that's true, because we never really truly get a release from this piece, right? It never, ever resolves,
right,
so to speak, right? It's very, I'll just come out and say it. I would never just sit down and listen to The Rite of Spring. I just wouldn't do it.
Sure.
It's not my kind. I appreciate it. I know how brilliant it is. I know what it did for music. All of that, but it is not what I'm going to turn on to my stereo to listen to.
Sure.
It's just not.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating. You know, you said it before. It's such a fascinating choice for Disney to put into this piece.
Yeah, because Stravinsky was still a popular composer. And
absolutely.
Firebird, which is much more what we'll call tonal, palatable for a contemporary audience.
Yes.
Could have easily been a choice to put in the movie.
Oh, totally. And I'm sure it was on the list.
Yeah. One thing I was struck by when I rewatched the sequence is, so I think we're so accustomed to now having such sort of a detailed image in our minds of what dinosaurs look like from Jurassic Park, all 12 of them or however many, right? And I was trying to think, in 1937, when they were animating it, what visual representations of dinosaurs did the animators have? Because I don't know if it had ever been in film before, or certainly not animation, I don't think.
Well, Gertie the dinosaur. You're forgetting Gertie. Ah. Don't forget Gertie.
So yes, you're right. Almost forgot.
But they all look like Gertie.
Yeah. Yeah.
They all have that same appearance, right? They all have that same. And I think the only reason they had to have studied fossils, because it would be the only reason we would get different kinds of dinosaurs out of them. Yeah. And I also find it interesting that the most detailed dinosaur is the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Right.
When the bad guy comes out, he's the most detailed. He's the one that has scales. He's the one that, you know, is more fully fleshed out as a character.
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating.
Right. And from a, like you were saying, from a violent perspective, like It's all. This is another violent one.
It's very violent throughout the whole thing.
Got a G rating.
Yeah, I. You know, the creation of the Earth is a violent happening, right? Mm-hmm. It was a very violent happening, and I think they represent that really well. But if I were a little kid going and seeing that, that would have scared me.
Oh yeah.
I would have been scared watching all those explosions and everything that was happening. It would have freaked me out.
Yeah.
And then they bring us to the intermission. I love that they end the first half. It's like okay,
there's the
survive that. Here's the release. Let's take a breath. And one of the things I loved about the intermission, and I know these are just such silly things, but I love, first of all, that you watch all the orchestra members leave. You watch them all leave. They're all gone. Until they're all gone. And there are audience sounds in it. There are audience sounds of the audience going to intermission. And then you hear that my very favorite on both sides of the intermission is hearing the squeaking of the curtain open and close. I just thought that was so brilliant. I was like, yep. That's what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
If you were on that stage, that's what that curtain would sound like.
Yep.
It's not quiet. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. That's what they did. Mm-hmm. And when it came out in movies, there really was a 15-minute intermission.
Oh yeah.
Between reels. And so,
and that was, you know, more common then. I mean,
much more common. Gone with the Wind has an intermission built into it. Yeah. Oh no, it was very
West
common
Side Story. Yeah.
All of them. Nobody expected you to sit for 2 hours in the movie theater.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody expected that.
Yeah.
You had to have a chance to go up and use the bathroom or whatever needed to be done. Get your popcorn. I personally would not. There are some movies that I personally, I think, need an intermission.
Sure.
I think a 4-hour movie is too long. I think a 3-hour movie is pushing it as too long. There are people that could say, well, yeah, but if you stop a Marvel movie, a 3-hour Marvel movie in the middle for intermission, you're going to ruin the flow of the movie. You're going to ruin the tension. Well, no, you wouldn't, because you would design it to have that intermission, right? It would be a smart cut. It wouldn't be like they would just be in the middle of a battle and go, okay, intermission.
Pause.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's something that a lesson we could learn from our forefathers, artistic forefathers, that we still use in the theater sometimes.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Thank goodness. Well, intermission seems like a good place to pause this episode, to stop this episode of the Magic Music Review on Fantasia from 1940. This is a long one. Obviously, it's a long show. I'm so glad that you stick with us to the end of the first act of this episode. Please join us next time when we take on the second act after the intermission of Fantasia 1940. Aaron and I will again go through each piece of music and discuss the music and the animation that is used with the music. If you like this podcast, please like and subscribe it from wherever you get your podcast. And if you leave us a 5-star review, 5-star rating and review, it really helps this podcast and helps other people find out about this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I truly appreciate all of you. Feel free to reach out, leave me a message. Tell me what you'd like to hear. I have a full list of things I'd like to talk about, but I'd love to hear what you want to know about and what you'd like to hear. You can either reach me by leaving a comment for this podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or you can find me at thegoofyguy.com and leave a comment there. Leave a message there. Send me a message. Until next time, when we do the second half of Fantasia from 1940, I look forward to talking to you soon. Have a great day.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company.
Soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.